the money, if I was prepared to perform some extra services for him every now and then. Yes, darling, I can see by the look on your face that you've guessed what those services were. Well, I was such a dreamy, naive girl. I was just so relieved that I wasn't going to lose my job or go to jail. And I could still buy my precious fabric. You know what I actually remember thinking? That Mr. Egghead had been sent by Mum to keep me out of trouble. Like he was my guardian angel. I thought I'd have to make him the occasional cup of tea. Mr. Egghead took it very slowly. I had to meet him in the storeroom, and he'd make me close the door behind me. And then it was down to business. At first, it was just a kiss on the cheek. And I thought, oh gosh, that's not so nice. I'd much rather make him a cup of tea. But then I thought, after all, I had done the wrong thing. I probably deserved it. And it wasn't that bad. Of course, he started doing more and more, and I started to feel so ashamed of myself. I truly believed I was a disgusting person, a dirty thief. And of course, one day Mr. Egghead took advantage of me during the morning tea break. Well, technically, he raped me. But then again, I never said no, of course. It didn't actually occur to me to say no. I was the bad person. I was the one being punished. I just tried very hard to think of something else. Chapter 52. Margie is bathing Ron's black eye with saline solution. He sits slumped at the kitchen table, while she stands next to him and looks dispassionately at the top of his head. That luxuriant dark hair is starting to thin, so she can see his baby white, vulnerable scalp. When she first met Ron, she thought he was so good-looking, she was embarrassed to even meet his eyes. That was the problem. She'd thought he was too good for her, and that she should be eternally grateful to him for choosing her. In fact, he was quite lucky to have her. When she'd shown Sophie the old photo of her in her red bikini, she'd wolf-whistled and said she was like a supermodel. And then she said, "No, Margie, I'm serious," in that funny way of hers. Ron winces heroically as she dabs at the cut on his eyebrow and says, "Do you want to go on a picnic today?" Margie stops dabbing while a bubble of laughter inflates in her chest. "Oh, that's okay. I don't think you're in any condition for a picnic." All those times he'd sneered when she tentatively suggested they take a bottle of wine down to Sultana Rocks. All those times when the children were young, when at the last minute he'd say Daddy had to stay behind and do some work in his office because Daddy made the money that paid for the nice food they were taking on the picnic, as if Mummy and Scribbly Gum Island didn't contribute a bloody cent. "I'm okay, if you feel like a picnic." "I don't feel like a picnic." "Right. You know what I could do today?" "What?" "I could put that picture up for you. The one with the flower pot." Actually, Debbie saw that and she thought it might be nice for Lily's room, so I gave it to her about a year ago. "Ah. Did you?" There is silence. Margie gives his forehead a last dab and says, "Right, that should do you." "I think it's too late, love."
So you had fun last night at that thing with your friend? With Ron? Loved it. Can't remember the last time I had more fun. Great. It's great to have an interest. Of course, it would have been nice to win first prize, not just runner-up. Oh, yes, trip to Venice. Wonderful. You always wanted to go to Italy, didn't you? You're thinking of Laura. She was the one who always went on about going to Europe. She notices he doesn't ask what they would have done if they had won first prize, which was a trip for two. Actually, she and rotund Ron hadn't ever properly discussed it. Sometimes their personal trainer, a blonde Amazonian called Susie, would say, "So what happens if you win? Are you two going to run away together to Venice?" And Ron would waggle his eyebrows suggestively and pretend to speak in an Italian accent, and Margie and Susie would make fun of him because he sounded Indian, not Italian at all. Last night, rotund Ron and Margie had been first runners-up in the national Bulges to Biceps beginner bodybuilding competition for couples, sponsored by a low-fat Italian pasta sauce company. Ron had heard about the competition and suggested to Margie that instead of going to their Weight Watchers meetings, they hire themselves a personal trainer and enter the competition. "We'll probably lose the same amount of weight," he'd said when he presented his proposal over their skim cappuccinos, "but we'll have much more fun." He told her that he'd picked her out of all the ladies at Weight Watchers because she looked like someone with a good sense of humour. And Margie, who'd never thought of herself as having any sense of humour at all, was ridiculously flattered. To enter the competition, they had to take a before photo of themselves in their swimming costumes, holding up newspapers to prove just how fat they were on that particular date. Margie came out of the changing room with her robe pulled bashfully around her, ready to display the appropriate shame of a fat person. But rotund Ron wasn't having any of that. He came strutting out like he was Mr. Universe, and soon had Margie quite weak with laughter, and even striking Miss Universe poses herself. Perhaps because she wanted to prove that she did have a sense of humour. It was as if she'd started to become an entirely different person. A flippant, confident, funny person. The sort of person rotund Ron believed her to be. And damn it, maybe he was right. Over the next 8 weeks, they'd met Susie 3 times a week, sweating and puffing and chortling at each other. They shared their ecstasy as their bodies began to change. They tried to outdo each other when they did their sit-ups and push-ups and tricep dips and bicep curls. When it hurt too much, they made very rude comments about Susie under their breaths. They knew each other's bodies as well as their own. "Feel that," Ron would say, pointing at his thigh. "Nothing but solid muscle, baby." After each training session, they'd have a protein shake in the park. Sitting on a bench, red-faced, dripping with sweat, and laughing. Always laughing. Margie had not had an affair with rotund Ron. They'd never so much as kissed. But in some ways it felt like the whole experience of transforming their bodies had been more intimate, more physical, more sexy, more spiritual than any old affair involving middle-of-the-day sex in horrible, sleazy highway motels and, well, whatever else those affairs involved. On the night of the competition held at the Hilton Hotel, the before photos were displayed on a giant screen behind each transformed couple, flexing their spray-on tanned biceps and triceps and quadriceps in a carefully choreographed routine. Rotund Ron and Margy had to avoid eye contact while doing their routine to Eye of the Tiger, because otherwise they were liable to dissolve into laughter. And Susie said she was going to be furious with them if they ruined her hard work with an attack of the giggles. But on the night, they'd both got caught up in the adrenaline-charged atmosphere and got all trembly and competitive before they went on stage. Afterwards, they were euphoric with their achievement, even when a ferociously muscular pair of born-again Christians from Balcombe Hills won the first prize. Margy and Ron won a flat-screen TV, which they agreed to donate to a centre for kids with cancer, because Ron's best friend's son had died of cancer 20 years earlier. It was when Rotund Ron, Susie and Margy were all sharing a celebratory glass of champagne that Margy got the phone call from Ron and learned that he'd got into a violent argument with a taxi driver at Glass Bay who didn't want him dripping river water all over his cab and couldn't care less that Ron was trying to get to the Hilton to drag his wife from a jacuzzi. Unfortunately, the taxi driver happened to have started an introductory course in Taekwondo at the Glass Bay Evening College, and after Ron threw his first clumsy punch, the taxi driver executed a perfect kick to Ron's temple. The police were called, and when Ron wouldn't calm down, they decided he was drunk and disorderly and threw him in the back of a paddy wagon, which was jam-packed with excited, swaying young men from a drunk and disorderly bucks party. Margy, Rotund Ron, and Susie drove over to the police station to pick up Ron, and all the drunk bucks got to hear them explaining to Ron that no, they weren't having an affair, they'd been entering a bodybuilding competition and they'd won a flat-screen TV. The glassy-eyed groom, who didn't seem to Margy to be in any state to get married the next day, became quite emotional, grabbing Ron's arm and slurring, "She wouldn't cheat on you, mate. She loves you. She made a solemn vow to you. She's your wife, man. She was just doing a bit of innocent bodybuilding and now you got a flat-screen TV." While the rest of the bucks competed to get Susie's phone number by offering to arm wrestle her. It was all a bit embarrassing. The Glass Bay police thought it was hilarious. She and Ron had taken the boat back over to the island in silence. Ron held an ice pack to his eye while Margy steered the boat and looked up at the stars and thought what a funny old world it was. When they were nearly at the wharf, Ron had removed his ice pack for a second and said, "Did you know our daughter was a lesbian?" And Margy had grinned at him and said, "Yes, I did. I had a lovely lunch with her and Audrey last week." And Ron had said, "Oh," and pressed the ice pack back to his eye. Now, Ron drums his fingers on the kitchen table and says nervously, We could take a trip to Italy, if you like. You and me. A second honeymoon." Margy turns around from the sink and looks at him. It's as if some sort of blurry substance has been peeled from her eyes, and she can see him clearly for perhaps the first time in her life. An uncertain, greying, middle-aged man with a secret terror he's not as smart or as classy as he'd like to be. A man who pretends he doesn't care what other people think when he cares desperately. A man who despises himself so much that the only way he can alleviate his feelings of inferiority is by stomping down his wife's personality with a daily stream of nasty jibes. A little man. A man with a foolish wife who should simply have said, "Don't speak to me like that." Maybe if she had, She could have saved both of them. She sits down in front of Ron and says, I'm not really interested in going to Europe. What I'd really like is to drive around Australia. I've always wanted to drive across the Nullarbor. We could do that. Get a four-wheel drive? No, I mean on my own. I'd like to take a holiday on my own. For a couple of months. Oh. His face gets all pulpy with hurt. Oh. Okay. I think it might be good for us to spend some time apart. Don't you? I don't mean an official separation or anything. Just a break. It seems like a good time now that we're talking about closing down the Alice and Jack business. And then we can think about what we'd like to do. Oh, he says again. Okay, yep. That's a good idea. Margie feels suddenly sick with this horrible new power. Well, she says, I'm going to call Callum and see how Grace is. She stays sitting, and she's about to reach over and pat his shoulder. But her new, strong body doesn't move. And after a few seconds, she stands up and goes to the phone and leaves him sitting there studying his knuckles. Maybe she'll call him from some outback town and say, come and meet me. Or maybe she won't. She really has no idea. Chapter 53. Rose's story is interrupted while they move into the living room, in the hope that Rose will be more comfortable on Sophie's couch. They experiment with cushions behind her back until she says she thinks that's about as good as they can manage. Sophie feels a sick horror over Rose's revelation. The scrambled eggs sit unsteadily in her stomach. Rose is too pure and fragile to even say the word rape. That's so horrible. Sophie awkwardly touches Rose's thin shoulder. What happened to you? Oh, darling, it's okay. It was a very long time ago, answers Rose serenely. There's no need to be upset. You're just like Veronica. We only just managed to save her from breaking one of Laura's good mugs. She was very agitated. She couldn't understand why I didn't go straight to the police. But it's a different era now. You modern girls are a lot better informed and a lot more assertive, which is a good thing. The problem was, I truly believed I was the criminal. Rose pats Sophie's arm as if she is the one who should be comforted and says, Oh, sugar, I brought a photo to show you. It's in my bag still in the kitchen. Sophie leaps to her feet and goes to the kitchen, conscious of how freely she can move around compared to Rose. The photo is of Connie, Rose and their mother dressed up in hats and gloves for a day out in the city. They're walking down a street, arms caught mid-swing, and both girls are looking at their mother and laughing. They used to have street photographers in those days who would take your photo without you even knowing, says Rose. Then they'd give you a card and you could go to this place on George Street and see if you'd like to buy it. Mum felt sorry for the photographer, so we bought this one. It was a few weeks before she got sick. You are so beautiful. Sophie looks at Rose's young, laughing face. I bet you were like Grace and didn't even realize how beautiful you were. Oh, I could be vain, says Rose. Look at me with my long hair. The fashion was short bobs, but I was so proud of my long blonde hair, I refused to cut it. She caresses her mother's face with an age-spotted bent finger. That's the coat Mum lost in the train. It was navy. Good wool. A tear runs down her withered cheek. Oh, Mum, you silly thing. Sophie feels her own eyes sting as she looks at 14-year-old Rose and thinks of the terrible things that were about to happen to her. She wants to go back in time and protect her and Connie. Take them along to an ATM and withdraw as much cash as they need. Buy their mum a new coat on her credit card and take her to the doctor on her Medicare card. March into David Jones and buy a whole damned roll of turquoise crepe de chine. Punch Mr. Egghead in the nose and then get him charged with sexual harassment before he even has a chance to lay a single sleazy finger on Rose. Well, says Rose, on with my story. Connie always said there's nothing worse than a person who keeps meandering from the point. So, it was only a few days later that Mr. Egghead got transferred to another department, and a few weeks after that I started falling asleep at the counter in the afternoon. I was 15 years old, Catholic, and pregnant. It was quite a scandal for those days, darling, quite a scandal. And I had an awful suspicion that my father might actually kill me. I could imagine him quite calmly picking up his Bible and thumping me to death with it. Well, Connie guessed it eventually, and I told her what had happened. I remember we were sitting down at Sultana Rocks, and Connie had a stick, and she was making holes in the sand. And as I told the story, she jabbed harder and harder until the stick broke, and she threw it hard across the water. Then she gave me a hug, a very quick, hard hug. We weren't ever a very cuddly family, so it was special. It meant that she didn't think I was a dirty thief who deserved her punishment. Then she picked up another stick and started jabbing more holes in the sand, but this time in orderly rows, and I knew she was trying to think out a solution. I remember closing my eyes and feeling so relieved, because now it was Connie's problem. I completely abdicated responsibility to her. So I can't really complain. The normal practice in those days for unmarried Catholic girls was that you were sent off, all very hush-hush, to a home in the country, where you had your baby and it was quickly whisked away for adoption. Well, Connie wasn't having any of that. She was determined that we would keep it. She was more interested in the baby than I was, to be honest. She was grieving for Mum too, of course, and I think the baby gave her something to focus on. She was also determined to save my reputation, which seems funny these days, but she didn't want word getting around Glass Bay that I was used goods. She thought I'd still meet a nice young man and settle down and get married. I remember she walked up and down the beach, jabbing with her stick for ages, until she finally marched back, looking very triumphant, and said, "Alice and Jack Munro are going to have a baby." I said, "Fine, Alice and Jack have a baby, and then what? What happens to them?" She said, "They vanish. Poof. We're not even going to try to come up with an explanation. They're going to vanish into thin air, just like the people aboard the Mary Celeste. It's perfect. It's absolutely perfect." She had a fondness for unsolved mysteries, you see, and the Mary Celeste was one of her favorites. She thought this would solve everything. We could keep the baby, save my reputation, and people would hear about Scribbly Gum Island. Once people get a whiff of scandal, they'll want to come here for a sticky beak, she said. We'll be ready and waiting with scones and tea. Light, fluffy scones. We'll put Banksia Island right out of business. Well, I thought she was joking or temporarily insane. But that very day she told Dad that Alice Munro was expecting. He said, well, as long as they keep paying their rent, that's all we care about. Connie said, I think they're doing it tough, Dad. We'll have to keep an eye on them. One day, she said, I promised that if anything ever happened to the Munros, that we'd look after their baby. And Dad snapped, what the bloody hell did you say that for? And Connie said, I was being a good Samaritan, Dad, just like in the Bible. And that shut him up. I didn't see how we would hide my pregnancy from Dad, but Connie said he wouldn't notice. She said he didn't look at us. I didn't see how it would be possible not to notice your daughter was 9 months pregnant. But Connie was right. I just wore loose clothing, and I never got very big anyway. Looking back, I think the poor man was close to being legally blind. That's why he hardly left the house. Or maybe he did notice, and he just didn't want to know. Maybe he saw through the whole thing. Who knows? I had to give up work, of course, when I got to 3 months. The ladies at the department store had beady eyes. Luckily, Connie got a job doing office cleaning, and she spent the next 6 months turning Grandpop's house into Alice and Jack's house. She put a couple of Mum's old dresses in the cupboard. She managed to get a free crib from the Salvation Army. It was like a project for her. I think she enjoyed it. I remember the day she came up with the idea of the half-finished crossword. She was tickled pink. Well, I didn't take much notice of it all, really. I was in a funny state at that time. The experience with Mr. Egghead had quite, well, shaken me up, I suppose. I spent hours fishing and trying not to think. I honestly didn't think we'd get away with it. I thought we'd both end up in jail. Of course, there was the problem of who would deliver the baby when it came. We could hardly go to a hospital, because what would we do about the birth certificate? Connie was thinking about confiding in a friend who was a midwife, but she really didn't trust anybody with the secret. Well, in the end, we didn't have a choice. I started getting contractions 3 weeks early. It was one of those stormy, dramatic days. Connie took me around in the boat to Grandpop's house. The water was all choppy, and I was out of my mind with fear. We got up to the house, and I had Enigma on the kitchen floor in about half an hour. Connie delivered her. She cut the cord with our grandmother's old kitchen scissors. Her hands were all slippery, and she was shaking so much she cut herself. So that's her blood on the kitchen floor, and probably some of mine, too. I remember Connie kneeling there with tears streaming down her face, blood dripping from her hand, holding Enigma. She loved Enigma instantly. It took me much longer. Actually, to be honest, Sophie darling, I could hardly bear the sight of her for quite a few months. I was worried she had an egg-shaped head. Don't ever tell her that, will you? I still think it has a slightly eggy shape to it at times. Connie was crying with joy, while I cried for my mother. Well, we cleaned the baby and wrapped her up and took her home to Dad. And we told him the story about going around to have a cup of tea with Alice and Jack and finding the baby. It was a test to see if he swallowed it. But he did. Hook, line, and sinker. At first he said we'd just have to take the baby to the hospital in Glass Bay and have it put in care. But Connie kept saying, "We made a promise, Dad." And then the funniest thing happened. Connie gave him the baby to hold, and his face melted, went soft and smooth. He said, "Well, as long as she doesn't wake me up at night," and handed her back. The next morning, Connie said to me, "This is your last chance to change your mind," as if any of it was my idea. And she went off to the police station and told them we'd found an abandoned baby. Then the newspapers sent around Jimmy to do a story. And funnily enough, I think Connie and I both really started to believe in it. Alice and Jack seemed more real to me than Mr. Egghead whispering vile things in my ear. Connie was right. The very day after the story appeared, a boatload of sticky beaks turned up at the island, and we were ready, with a tray of freshly baked scones. Tuppence and halfpenny with a cup of tea. Connie didn't tell Jimmy the truth until after he came back from the war, and he was furious. The Munro baby mystery had been the story that started his career, and he was horrified that it was a hoax. He took a long time to forgive Connie. That was when Connie came up with the idea of not telling Enigma until she was 40. I think it threw her when she realized she'd hurt Jimmy's feelings. People don't like to feel they've been conned, do they? Especially men. Men take themselves so seriously. Connie had this idea that by the time Enigma got to the age of 40, she'd be mature enough to handle it. Actually, I think Enigma was mostly worried about whether she'd stay famous. As the years went by, I started to think that maybe we could come clean about the whole thing. I wanted Enigma to know that I was her mother, but she was really more Connie's daughter than mine, especially in those first few months after she was born when I went to touch Barmy. I barely touched her. Connie brought her up, really. I was just like a big sister. I remember I felt hurt when Enigma asked Connie if she could call her mum. But what could I do? Connie was her mum. If it wasn't for her, I probably wouldn't have been able to keep her. And when Connie and Jimmy couldn't have their own children, and she so badly wanted them, I could hardly say I wanted Enigma just for me. Besides which, by then the Munro baby mystery had become a successful business. When Dad died in 1940, we had made more money than we'd ever dreamed of. Whenever Connie thought interest in the Munro mystery was starting to wane, she'd come up with something new to get people talking again. After the war, she wrote all those letters from Alice to Jack and pretended to find them in the cake tin under the bed. Confidentially, Sophie, those letters were really all about Connie's feelings about her marriage to Jimmy. They were going through a bit of a bad patch. So Jimmy sat down and wrote that beautiful love letter from Jack to Alice. Connie cried when she read it. You've read it, haven't you? He could be romantic when he wanted to be, that Jimmy. Then, of course, in the 1970s, when our numbers were very low, Connie read The Female Eunuch and decided that Alice was being emotionally castrated, and she sat down and wrote Alice's diary in 2 days and got Margie to discover it under the floorboards. I remember Jimmy saying, "Nobody is going to fall for this rubbish. How many more historical documents can be hidden in one small house? Well, that diary caused a sensation because it implied that Alice probably bumped off Jack, and the feminists just loved that. After that, we all agreed there couldn't really be any more discoveries. There were so many times when I felt such a strong desire to tell everyone the truth, but Connie was like a stubborn old... Is that the phone again, Sophie? No, I'll answer it. I'm finished. That's the end of my story. Chapter 54. Oh, you're there. I've been trying to call all morning. Sorry, I slept in. I had a bit too much to drink last night. Me too. The mulled wine was... Yes. It sure was. Yes. Well. So. How is Grace? She's fine, physically, but one of the doctors talked to me this morning, and she seems to think that Grace has postnatal depression. Oh, dear. Oh, well... Shit, I should have thought of that. I had a friend who had it. I seem to have been missing the obvious lately. Oh, God, you don't think she purposely... Yeah, maybe. She says it was an accident, but I don't know. She's so careful about what she eats. I should have seen it. Actually, I thought maybe she was depressed a while back, but everybody kept telling me she was fine. They kept going on about those thank you cards she made and how no depressed woman could have managed that. It wasn't as if she was crying all day. Or not in front of me, anyway. But I did know something was different. I should have... Anyway, she's going to get help now. That's not why I'm calling. I wanted to say to you about last night... Oh, no. Don't say anything. You don't need to say anything. We'll just pretend it never happened. It was just the wine. Don't even think about it. It's not important, especially not now. It is important. I wanted to say, I'm so sorry for pushing you away like that. And I wanted to say that it's okay. Please don't say anything more. I don't want you to think it didn't mean anything. I don't want you thinking it was just the wine, even though the wine... But it wasn't just the wine. Oh, fuck. You don't need to say this. The thing is, I really love Grace. Of course you do. Please, stop it. I would never be unfaithful to her. You don't need to say this. But I just want you to know... That if I'd met you before I met Grace, you know, that whole other lifetime thing. This sounds like such cliched crap, but I'm serious. I just want you to know that you mean something to me. That if things had been different, then things would have been different. Oh, Jesus, I sound like a lunatic. Please stop it. Okay. But do you see what I'm saying? Yes, I do. Thank you. Okay. Okay. I'm sorry. There's nothing to be sorry for. Okay. Okay. Are you laughing or crying? A bit of both. Oh. Let's never talk about it again, all right, Callum? Not one word. or even a meaningful look, especially no meaningful looks. All right? You promise? All right. No meaningful looks. I promise. Send my love to Grace. I will. Chapter 55. Grace sits in her hospital room with her mother, looking at the lunch which has just been delivered by a sour-faced woman shoving a trolley. Callum has gone home to relieve Veronica and Audrey of Jake, and the doctors have said that he can come back and pick up Grace later this afternoon. Grace feels shaky and surreal. Her throat is still sore, as if somebody had tried to strangle her, and her leg is aching and bruised from where her mother jabbed in the EpiPen. She is not allowing her mind to form any complete thoughts about what happened last night. She's just reveling in the relief of oxygen flowing unimpeded into her lungs. In, out, in, out. Laura lifts an aluminium lid from a plate, and her nostrils contract with disgust. There's no excuse for food of this quality. It's just laziness. Look at that sandwich. Appalling. The bread is stale. Are you hungry? We'll get you something when we get home. When I spoke to Veronica, she mentioned the freezer was very well stocked. She counted 11 lasagnas. Callum's favourite, says Grace. You always said your lasagnas were better fresh. Her mother pauses and pokes a manicured finger at the offending sandwich and says, did you deliberately eat that samosa last night? Grace pleats the thin white hospital blanket between her fingers and breathes. In, out, in, out. She doesn't want to think about the failure of the plan. She just wants to enjoy breathing. You're just normally so careful, says Laura. Grace manages to speak. I forgot. I was distracted. Distracted? Repeats Laura. Distracted by what? Grace says, do you remember that day when I nearly ate a sesame bar in front of you? Laura smiles as if pleased to be reminded of a favourite joke. Of course I do. You are a little minx at that age. I thought you were going to let me die. I sure called your bluff. I seriously thought you were going to let me die. Ah. Laura rolls her eyes. So what, did I psychologically damage you or something? Is that what you're saying? Because life wasn't easy for me after your father left. All very well for Margie to be the perfect mummy. She had a husband. She had Ron. Grace is talking in her normal voice. She feels invigorated. She wasn't exactly blissfully happy. She wasn't a deserted wife like me. Laura examines her nails critically and takes some hand cream out of her handbag. Anyway, the fact is, I was never motherly like Margie. She played with dolls while I played with Mum's makeup. So I'm sorry, okay? Some people just aren't motherly. I've been thinking a lot while I was traveling, and I've come to realize that. I wasn't ready to be a mother. I didn't even especially want to be a mother. It was your father who wanted a baby. I hope that's not traumatizing for you to hear, but it's the truth. And it's about time we all started telling the truth in this family. And then when he left us for that bitch who was a size 14 and couldn't cook to save her life, I never dealt with it, you see. I let it fester, like an abscess. I haven't been happy for years. I've wasted my entire life mourning a dentist, for heaven's sake. It hit me while I was looking at the Mona Lisa. I had an epiphany. It was something about that knowing smirk of hers. Her thinking, yeah, all men are bastards, but we women just have to knuckle down and get on with it. I decided I needed to make some fundamental changes in my life. I'm going to start by having a chemical peel, because my skin is just dreadful. What? You had an epiphany while looking at the Mona Lisa and decided to have a chemical peel? Grace laughs, and it feels like the first taste of fizzy champagne after a long period of non-drinking. Well, the chemical peel was just about regaining confidence in my looks. I'm going to start from the outside in. I also want to do a course. In art history, perhaps. Or ceramics. You're not the only arty one in the family, you know. You certainly didn't get your talent from your father's side of the family. And I'm going to try and be a good grandmother to Jake. Not a snuggly, cuddly nana, but an interested, involved, stylish sort of grandmother. You know, I'll take him to museums. That sort of thing. When he's older, of course. Not now. I won't be so much help with him now. To be honest, I find babies quite terrifying. Well, so do I, thinks Grace. Of course, you've got Margie to help you. Laura finishes massaging the cream into her hands and offers the tube to Grace, who shakes her head. She replaces the lid and takes a deep, brave breath. Is there something the matter, Grace? Have you been finding it hard coping with Jake? Callum mentioned one of the doctors thought you might have postnatal depression. Look, you don't need to tell me if you don't feel comfortable talking about it. You'd better see a psychiatrist, don't you think? You can tell him. Or her. Which would you prefer? A woman would be more intelligent, obviously. Grace says, I didn't know you carried around an EpiPen. Callum said you were so calm when you used it. When you were younger, I used to practice giving injections to a banana. I was a nervous wreck at the thought. It's not that difficult, of course. Any fool could do it. You should have had your own in your handbag. But then I suppose if you were trying to kill yourself, that was the point. Laura's face crumbles slightly, and Grace notices spidery wrinkles above her mother's upper lip. They make her feel protective towards her, big sisterly. Laura says, you're not going to try and do it again, are you? I forgot the samosas had walnuts in them, insists Grace. Really? Asks her mother. Really? Laura looks at her fingernails again and says, Grace, I wasn't going to let you kill yourself when you were 13. I had my hand hovering over my bread roll, ready to throw it at you and knock the sesame bar from your hand. I can assure you it was never even going to get close to your mouth. Oh. Grace's voice sounds hoarse. I know I don't exactly qualify as Mother of the Year material, and I know I made some silly mistakes. But you're my daughter. I would have died for you, for heaven's sake. Grace examines her own fingernails. I still would. That's just, you know, the way it is. Grace looks up and meets her mother's eyes. Laura smiles uneasily and then brightens, peering closer at Grace's face.
Your eyebrows look like they could do with a wax.
We could get Margie to mind Jake one day, and you and I could go and have facials done. Would you like that?
That would be nice.
It would be awful. Grace hates facials. They make her feel claustrophobic. But still, the principle of the idea is nice. They lapse into silence. Grace watches her mother twiddling the red stone on her new necklace, glancing around the room with that familiar mix of tension and disdain. She imagines Laura, about the same age that Grace is now, sitting alone in the kitchen, jamming the EpiPen into a banana, two lines of fear etched between her eyes. Grace breathes in and out. In and out. Oxygen flows in through her nostrils and expands her chest. There is a vase of flowers sitting on the windowsill. The flowers are a deep grape colour, similar to the colour of Aunt Rose's new jumper. She'd like to paint them and discuss mixing the right colour with Rose. She'd quite like a cup of tea. She's looking forward to having a shower and washing her hair when she gets home. Beneath the rhythm of her breathing, she can just discern a whispery thought. Maybe it's going to be okay. Gublet McDoublet came back from the moon to find that his mum had been off having a chemical peel and her face was all red and flaky.
Oh, Gublet, she said sadly. Why did you run away to the moon? You silly Billy. Didn't you know I'd miss you?
Gublet just gave her an enigmatic Mona Lisa smile, because actually, he hadn't known that at all.
You seem glum today, Sophie darling, says Rose as she's leaving, wrapping her new pashmina around her.
I guess I've got a hangover from all that mulled wine, says Sophie. And I feel especially ugly today with this horrible cold sore.
Oh, well, it will get better, says Rose. You're a very pretty girl.
Says Sophie disbelievingly, like a sulky teenager.
Well, of course you are.
Oh, you know, there's something I keep forgetting to tell you. I was thinking about you the other day and your search for the right man, so to speak. And you know what I suddenly remembered? I remembered that one day Connie said to me that she'd discovered the perfect man for you. The darndest thing is, I can't remember who it was. Although I do remember thinking that I sort of agreed with her, although I felt disloyal to Thomas.
Was it Rick?
Sophie touches her cold sore. Or Ian, perhaps.
I really can't remember who it was. I was just thinking about how funny it was that Connie was so convinced that this man was your soulmate.
Wonderful. Fabulous. Oh, what does it matter anyway? The thought of meeting a new man at this stage while she's still so raw over Callum seems ridiculous and pointless.
His name's on the tip of my tongue. It will come to me.
I'll call you as soon as I think of it, says Rose.
Of course, you might not fancy the fellow at all.
Rose kisses her on the cheek, and Sophie breathes in her powdery scent. Thank you for telling me the story about Alice and Jack.
My pleasure, darling.
Chapter 56. It is the weekend after the anniversary night, and Callum is taking Grace to see their house in the mountains. They haven't been up for months, and he's hoping that they will be pleasantly surprised by how far it has progressed since they've seen it. Their builder has assured him that they will be thrilled, but Callum no longer likes the builder. In fact, he hates him, and has secret fantasies about knocking him out with a plank of wood, sending that smug orange hard hat flying. Jake is in his capsule in the back seat, singing to himself. This week, he has discovered his voice, a wonderful toy capable of creating a whole spectrum of interesting noises. When Jake is making his sounds, he squints his eyes in deep concentration, which is exactly the same expression that Callum used to see on Grace's face when he interrupted her working on one of her goblet paintings. It twists his heart. He and Grace are all tentative tiptoes around each other at the moment. They're so polite, it's almost comical. But Callum can't relax, because he's lost trust in his own character. He is completely appalled by himself. He thought he was superior to the sort of sleazy, shallow man who gets drunk and kisses another woman just a few months after his wife gives birth to their first child. He thought he was more evolved than that. And it wasn't just the mulled wine. He actually teetered on the brink of an affair. An evil, lecherous part of his mind was thinking it all out. Where can we go? Her house? Now? He'd wanted to sleep with Sophie. He still wants to sleep with Sophie. He wants to talk to Sophie, listen to CDs with Sophie, dance with Sophie, make love to Sophie, make her laugh, tease her. Oh, for Christ's sake. He is driving along with his wife beside him and his son in the back seat, having fantasies about another woman. But he doesn't want to leave Grace. Oh, no. Not at all. That's not an option. All these treacherous thoughts about Sophie seem quite separate from his helpless, hopeless love for Grace. He wants to have his cake and eat it too. Just like every fat, balding, middle-aged, unfaithful businessman throughout history. He is a tired cliche, a dirty joke. He has even caught himself thinking whiny, self-pitying thoughts like, "But Grace doesn't get me the way Sophie does. My wife doesn't understand me." And he doesn't understand her. He doesn't know what she's thinking anymore. He doesn't know if she does have postnatal depression or not. She says she doesn't. She says the doctor who suggested that had only spoken to her for 10 minutes and had no idea what she was talking about. She says she's fine. She smiles her beautiful smile and says, "Don't worry." He will never forget the panic he felt when she had her allergic reaction on the anniversary night. It was nightmarish. It was punishment for kissing Sophie. He doesn't know if Grace ate the samosa on purpose, like Laura is suggesting, because each time he goes to ask Grace, he's terrified she'll say, "Yes, I did." And then he'll have to say, "Why? Why did you do that?" And what if she answers, "Because I saw you kissing Sophie?" It gives him a stomach-lurching feeling of vertigo just thinking about it. So he says nothing at all. He acts as if it was just an accident, as if the doctor never mentioned postnatal depression, as if they're just a normal married couple, as if everything is fine, as if they still have sex, as if they still touch each other, as if a few weeks ago she didn't say, "You don't even know me." He talks to her each day like he's reading lines from a script. "Good morning. How did you sleep? Shall I put the baby down?" He speaks more naturally to the man at the service station where he buys his petrol each month than he does to his own wife. He tries out one of his jovial husband lines now. "Do you want to stop for a coffee before we see the house?" No, I'm okay, answers Grace. Unless you want to stop?
Only if you want to.
I'm fine.
Well, I'm fine too.
Callum clenches the steering wheel and looks straight ahead at the highway peeling away before him. Chapter 57.
Oh dear. Oh damn, where is she, I wonder? Okay, well, here we go. Hello? Sophie? It's Rose. I wanted to tell you that I remembered the name of that fellow Connie had picked out for you. It's Callum's friend and... Oh, dear, I don't think this silly machine is working, is it? Hello? Oh, sugar.
Chapter 58. Sophie wakes up early and goes to the bathroom to look at the progress of her cold sore, which looks quite pretty now, just like a smudge of pale pink lipstick. It's a pity all those horrible, humiliating feelings for Callum can't just dry up and fade away too, until there's nothing left but a nice, socially acceptable smudge of friendship. As she's cleaning her teeth, she decides to give herself her own version of electric shock aversion therapy. Every time she thinks of Callum, she will pinch herself hard above the elbow. She will train her mind like a rat in a maze. Today should be a good day to start training because she has something new to preoccupy her mind. A new life. Yesterday at Yum Cha, she and her mother unexpectedly came up with a new plan for Sophie's career. Gretel had started talking about that fraudulent psychic they'd met at the Korean baths, and who ever heard of a caramel aura? And why would Sophie, of all people, need a positive career change when she was already doing so well in her career? That's when Sophie admitted that, well, actually, she'd been coasting for the last couple of years at work, and that, while she still enjoyed it, she'd really gone as far as she could go there, and it wasn't really challenging her anymore. And all of a sudden she was talking to her mother about how she'd always thought that when she had children, she would give up work and do something part-time, something completely different, like teaching a wine-tasting course, or perhaps using her HR skills for something different, like career counselling for teenagers or hardened, handsome, unshaven young crims, and how she'd quite like to play the violin again in a string quartet like she did when she was at uni. Her mother had said that she might have had some unrealistic ideas about just how much spare time she'd have with a baby, but seeing as Sophie owned a house outright and didn't need to worry about her mortgage payments anymore, why didn't she just resign from work and take some time off and pursue some, if not all, of these ideas? Why not? Cried Gretel, excitedly spilling her green tea. Why not? Said Sophie, thoughtfully spearing a chopstick through her steamed pork bun. And just like that, the fraudulent psychic's prophecy came true. And today Sophie is sitting down with her notepad to consider an entirely new lifestyle and wondering why she'd never thought of it before. She thinks about how interested Callum will be and immediately pinches her arm so hard it brings tears to her eyes. She puts on her Eva Cassidy CD and thinks about what Callum said about this album and pinches her arm again. She would have thought she might have picked things up faster than the average rat. She's standing at the sink, pouring herself a cup of tea, when she sees a strange man standing on the balcony, with his face pressed up against the window, peering in.